Hi short film fans, and welcome to the Cameo Launch Short Film Showcase. I'm Nigel Morgan, your host, and today we're talking to the incredibly talented writer and director, Justin Robinson. Justin first came to our attention through his short film Snowbirds, which tells the story of a recently widowed lady desperately seeking one last goodbye with her husband, and Guest of Honor, which tells the story of a group of young women in Nazi Germany whose job it was to taste food meant for Hitler to determine whether or not it was poisoned. We reviewed and, spoiler alert, loved both films, and the links are available in the description. Justin's truly incredible accomplishment, however, came as a result of tragic loss with his documentary My Brother Jordan. This tells the story of the life and death of Justin's late brother Jordan Robinson, who sadly passed away of cancer in 2008. Tracking down family and friends all over the US over the course of 8 years, Justin compiled interviews and home videos totaling over 450 hours of footage and managed to distill it down into a 63-minute documentary. This film was released online in August of 2020, and at the time of recording has been viewed over 15 million times. We reviewed My Brother Jordan in late 2020, and unsurprisingly, we were utterly blown away. Again, the link to our review and the film is in the description. I was fortunate enough to be able to catch Justin Robinson via a video call, and he was incredibly generous with his time and open with his experiences, feelings, motivations, and his plans for the future. We're very excited to be able to share this interview with you, so please sit back and enjoy. So joining us this week is Justin Robinson, filmmaker and now author. Justin, thanks so much for joining us on the show today, man. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. Anytime.
Let's start all the way at the beginning, because you know I came across, I think the first thing that I found of yours was Snowbird. I think that was via Film Riot, and then I found Guest of Honor like directly after that. So now I saw the first one, I was like, oh, okay, this is good. Okay, let me see what else is going. By the time I'd seen Guest of Honor, I was like, okay, this guy's the real deal. So it was awesome. So can you kind of take us back to the beginning and sort of your start in film? What was the initial sort of impetus to start experimenting with video making?
Yeah, so that would go back to early 2000s, living in Florida, looking for stuff to do outside of going to the beach or playing basketball. And we had a VHS camera. And I took a liking to it because growing up, you know, we had filmed certain family events, like some families did at the time. And I always would watch whatever was filmed, Christmas, a basketball game, whatever. And then somehow I taught myself how to edit VHS to VHS, which I was fairly limited in even the skill that I had acquired. So I could basically only like make things happen repetitively like three times. So if it was like someone falling, I could like make the, I don't even remember how to do it now, but I was like a DJ. And could make something happen. So if somebody got punched, I could make it like three times. And that was the most amazing cinematic tool that we had. And then fast forward, one of my older brothers brought home an editing software from college and just started playing around and then illegally downloaded some old movie soundtracks in about 2004 and started editing and shooting videos on a handy cam. And it was just a way to have fun. I had no realization of filmmaking. I had no idea this was a career. I had no idea people lived and breathed it and didn't sleep it. And I just did it out of a joy, out of fun. It was something to do. It kept us busy, kept us occupied, kept me out of trouble for the most part. And then, of course, later, I traded a handy cam for the next kind of handy cam and the next one. And then fast forward to college when DSLRs came out. I got a 7D, a Canon 7D, when the DSLRs were all the craze, or a little bit before. And just started teaching myself how to shoot and what to look for, and had, again, no real jumping block of mentorship or anything. I mean, I was just watching stuff on YouTube and trying to learn, like a lot of people, and then just fell in love with it after my older brother died of cancer right before my senior year of high school. My desire to play basketball kind of transitioned into what I now know as filmmaking. At the time, it was making videos. And that's what kind of led me to where I'm at. So it's been a long journey of trying to teach myself how to do the next thing and the next thing and the next thing and do all those better than I did it the last time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, obviously we're gonna talk about my brother Jordan and everything that happened with your brother sadly passing and what drove you to make that movie as well. But I mean, one of the things that stuck out to me when I first saw it is that it kind of seemed to be In as much as it was about your brother, it was also kind of about your origin story as a filmmaker, as well as you kind of rediscovering the love of basketball over that long period. But kind of cycling back to your roots in filmmaking, had it been going for a while before you realized this is what I want to do? I mean, was it a case of you kind of had the bug but didn't realize for quite a long time, or did it kind of click for you one day?
I mean, I would say I did have a bug and didn't know it probably, or didn't know what type of bug it was. I mean, when I was making stuff in 2007 and 2008 with all the friends that I had at the time, none of them had an interest in film or acting or cinematography. So it was me just persuading, you know, 15, 20 people to come help me make something when they have no interest in doing it. And I saw that as a valuable tool, that if you could pool all these people together to have a good time, hopefully, and not be too bored, it was worth the time spent. So I was really aggressive in trying to make stuff because there weren't people around me that were, you know, pushing that zest that I had. So in a way, I had this very lonely bug and didn't know it probably till later when I actually kind of more or less understood the arithmetic of filmmaking and the, you know, mentality of a filmmaker and the skill needed and the time it deserves that you give it. And so I would say, yeah, I probably did have the bug and didn't know it, because I didn't have this concept for films, this concept for directing. So I didn't see Jurassic Park and say, I'm going to be Steven Spielberg. Mm-hmm. I didn't even have the wherewithal to even know to do that. So it was probably a long relationship, a long distance relationship with filmmaking that I just slowly merged when all of these things kind of fell out from under me and I kind of fell into filmmaking. And then it was like, this makes total sense. I have all these stories. My life is a weird, genreless, bizarre, you know, documentary, and I'd love to tell some of these stories. And I feel a responsibility with telling stories. And so it just, I guess I had the bug and didn't know it, and then it bit me, and I'm terminal, man. I got it. So here I am.
Awesome. I mean, it definitely seems from what I've seen, at least, that it's this one's lifelong. I mean, there was a fair amount of acting, particularly at the beginning stages as well. How did you fall into that? Was that kind of through necessity, or was there a bug there as well?
Yeah, there was no bug. Again, I had no concept for acting. I just, out of all the friends I had at the time, no one was jumping into the frame. Or if they were, it wasn't something where I was convinced as a director. So I thought, at least if I do it, I know I'll give 100%. I didn't have the tools or probably life experience to deliver any type of serious performance at the time, but it was just some way where I could get it out of my system and goof around and make my friends laugh, even if it's the three people behind the camera. If I could get the camera to shake, you know, the operator shaking, then that was a good time. So it didn't matter if anybody liked it at the end. So no bug there. I mean, I do have a very small interest from time to time of being in other directors' films as a very small role, just because I feel that's a way that I can support them. You know, some people say, hey, can you come help me on the film? And that might be being a crew member. It might be polishing the script. And at this point, it's like, hey, you know, if I can either help you with a script revision, or if you want to kill a guy in the background, I'll hit the deck for you. You know, so if that's a way to serve, that's kind of where I have a little bit of the bug, but it's more of a respect for the bug than the bug having me, I guess. So it was just necessity at the time. But there came a time in my college life, I was taking acting classes mainly to be able to communicate with actors better as a director, but I kind of learned so much. It was a theater acting class, and we did this one exercise where everyone was supposed to take on the persona, or, you know, act like a particular animal. So if I pick a gorilla and you pick a lion, you're supposed to walk around the lion. You're supposed to walk around the room on all fours. I walk around as a gorilla, and you're just supposed to interact. And it was this bizarre kind of freeing experience to where, for whatever reason, I was a chimpanzee / silverback gorilla, I guess. And it was a really freeing experience to where you just are able to kind of shed yourself. And, you know, I was someone, again, who was willing to act a fool, but it freed me. It just like took the chains off to where it helped me understand filmmaking, that what you give the camera is a gift, and what you give the camera is a powerful, powerful thing, and you should be willing to give it all. And that simple exercise by my acting teacher, Corey Danielly, she's a royal theater buff and a really tough teacher, but an amazing woman. But that exercise I come back to from time to time, where I was walking around as a gorilla, free as I've ever been. And I take that with me into directing, into any thoughts of acting, to be able to just, if you can be a gorilla, I mean, you can be a clerk at a hotel. I mean, you can be a lot of things if you can be a gorilla and believe it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, because just kind of going back and looking at some of those earlier ones, it was like Number 14 you directed, and it was Proximity that that you did with Film Riot. Those were incredibly physical, you know. I noticed you had a couple of stunt credits as well on IMDb. Yeah. So it definitely seemed like something that you properly committed to when you were in it and threw yourself into. And you know, I think that passion is self-evident, not just in acting, but kind of in the way that you approach anything that you write and direct or otherwise control from behind the camera. You mentioned that, you know, that discipline is something you take into different parts of filmmaking. How does that help you when relating to actors when you're directing them?
Well, hopefully it frees them up to be able to act like whatever animal they need to be. And I think being able, it's like doing a doc, when I did a documentary about my brother. So interviewing people, you know, it had been years since my brother had passed. And a lot of the people that are interviewed for most documentaries, including mine, were not familiar with being in front of a camera. And so there's that aspect that makes them nervous. They're talking about a heavy topic. They're talking about cancer. They're talking about death. They're talking to someone who has experienced the death of a loved one. So there's a lot of awkwardness to that. And so for me, what I learned very quickly is when I was about to interview them, if I kind of shared off camera how I feel about stuff, it freed them to be as honest as they could be. Because I'm saying I'm an open book. They're saying, I don't want to say something that might upset you. I'm like, no, bro, I drove 1,000 miles because I want to hear every little detail, every breadcrumb of my brother's life. If I don't know it, I want to know it. And I'm challenging you to give me something I don't know. So that aspect of being able to show that I'll bleed, I'll go with you. I'll hold your hand, I'll push you from behind, or I'll go up ahead and call you up. I'll be willing to do that. And so I think that gives the actors the confidence to, you know, be able to be free, because it's hard to act if you're not free. You know, maybe some people can do it better than others, but I want you to be free. You know, I want you to be able to communicate to me if we're friends, I want you to never have a block in our friendship to where you feel like you can't tell me something. That'd break my heart. In the world that we live in, if you feel something that you can't share, and in the same way on a set, that privacy, that intimacy, I want to have. And I know it's filmmaking and it's not quite often real life friends with whoever you're working with. Sometimes it is, and that's a great thing. But I want that freedom. I want that people to feel free. And so if I'm able to act a fool or to bleed in front of them, then I think often they're more willing to go the distance with you.
No, absolutely. And the thing is, I think people appreciate that, though, even if the movie itself is somewhat flawed, or, you know, maybe you didn't get that shot right, or maybe, you know, you threw a punch and they can see that you didn't actually connect or whatever. But, you know, I think people appreciate and they can see when you are actually giving your all and when you are actually being honest in front of the camera.
Yeah.
I mean, like some of the places that you took your actors to and stuff like Popeye the Pizza Man, for example, you know, those were some real places. I mean, not necessarily just dark or depressed or anything like that, but they were real. The sadness was real. The elation was real. The hope was real. You know, there's a serious spectrum there. And I think you've got to have serious trust in your director if you're going to go to those places. So when you're actually in the process of doing that, how important is kind of community in that moment? Because with short film in particular, you're probably not talking about a massive crew or anything like that. So how important is it to build a community between people in front of and behind the camera to get the actors to those places?
Yeah, it's radically important. I mean, I've been able to be friends and make crew members crew members help me direct by just their atmosphere on set. I mean, a person who's behind the camera just doing their normal thing has sometimes no idea the effect they might have on the scene that might affect the entire movie. I mean, the atmosphere on a set is often so fragile that some people are on the verge of these things, to where someone says the wrong thing, someone makes a noise at the wrong time, and often that can deflate and set people off. And hopefully that doesn't, not saying that people have a short fuse and anger, but it's something that's so palpable that if we're tender and sensitive about it, we're all on the same page, that if you have a crew member that's just trying to make Snapchats or, you know, post Instagram stories, they're probably not in the right headspace. And so I've been able to bring people on that understand that, and I'm making them responsible for their actions. So it's a test. It's a,
yeah,
you know, it's a couple almost interviews to up the ante on, hey, if you're here, you're helping me direct. You're not just the grip. You're not just the AC. You're not just like, you're right next to the camera. You're the first person that actor sees. You're an extension of me, so to speak. So I need you to be me. And I need you to care as much as you can. You're not going to care as much as me, but I think it's really valuable for me to bring people on that see the same things I see, or can at least see them from a distance. Then they'll get it. And I'm not asking everybody to be a director. I'm asking everybody to be aware of what's going on. And again, a lot of these qualities that I see in a crew, in a director, I see a need for as people. You know, we need to be more aware of our surroundings. We need to be more sensitive to what that person might be going through, you know? What are they wearing? Like, are their shoes untied? Or is their collar? You know, all the little details that you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes or Jason Bourne to notice. But if you actually looked at somebody, you looked at their eyes, you know, the eyes will tell you. And so I want crew members to be able to look the actors in the eyes and know where they're at. Because often we don't look long enough to know.
Right. Because I noticed that despite the very extensive amount of experience you've got working on sets, working features, you do tend to come back to short film. I mean, what is it about short film that has that appeal to you?
Yeah, so, I mean, short films for me have been just a place to paint, a place to try and learn something new every time. I mean, I've never had funding to where it would give me the opportunity to make a feature. So, and I didn't have the route when I was younger, like a lot of people did, that said, you have to make a feature film. Short films are nothing. Short films won't get you anywhere. You have to make a feature film. And then what I had seen more often than not is this inexperienced filmmaker goes and makes a pretty terrible feature and then doesn't really ever do much again. They might go and crew a movie, but as a director, as a writer, the failure was so big because it's their only one, instead of making a lot of smaller failures or smaller successes. And so for me, short film spoke to me in the sense that it was palatable for me. I could digest the time. I could convince people to do 1, 2, 3 days for free or little money to come and make this thing for me. And then I wasn't worried about it being the best short film ever. I wasn't worried about it going to the Oscars. I wasn't worried about it being a proof of concept. I was only focused on that. I want to tell this story and I want to suck less than I did the last time. And so short films have always been a really valuable thing for me. I mean, it's gotten me some sort of relationship and this and that and the other, and I can look back and not regret that thing I made, whether it's not a great piece of art. Short films are just a great place to learn, a great place to fail. You know, if I failed, it's only a few $1,000s of a failure. It's not a few $100,000. It's not a couple million. It's only $3,000 or $4,000 of my own money, usually, that it's a failure. When often a failure is a great way to learn. So growing up playing basketball, you know, I lost a lot of games, lost a lot of big games, won a few, but I learned probably so much more losing. I mean, the losing fueled me more than winning ever did. The losing brings you back tomorrow. Yeah. You know, the winning is today and tomorrow and forever, but that's something that, you know, I'm not against winning championships or whatever it is. I think that's a great thing, but I'm not afraid to lose.
That is definitely a bigger driver to improve and to learn than winning is. Again, no shade on winning, but you know, I think just going back to what you were saying about short films being a great place to fail, they're also increasingly now, I think, a great place to succeed as well, because there's no sort of financial pressure, there's no industry pressure to make X kind of movie with this person, and it has to make this much at the box office and all that kind of stuff. It's a completely freeing environment to experiment, to tell different types of stories. Some will connect, some won't, that's fine. But the fact that you have that kind of artistic freedom just kind of opens up so much possibility, so much creative possibility. And when you look at just your filmography on its own, there's a lot of variety there. I mean, you look on one end and there's an assassin movie. You look on another end and there's, you know, an old lady trying to come to terms with the loss of her partner. And, you know, and there's a thematic through line through all of that. and there's a passion to tell a story through all of that. And I don't think that a lot of those avenues might have been available to you, even if somebody had, you know, reversed a dump truck up to your door full of money and said, come direct this huge movie. So that being the case, when you're doing all of that, how do you kind of channel that into finding a team and finding people to kind of share that journey or trust in the vision that you've got?
That's a good question. I mean, just from being a crew member, I spent a lot of time second ACing. I spent a lot of time as a PA, as some sort of assistant director, and just get to meet a lot of actors. You get to meet a lot of crew. And of course, from a distance, you get to see people succeed and fail and lose their temper and be incredibly patient. And so there was a lot of people from time to time that I would kind of say in the back of my head, if I'm building an army to make movies for the rest of my life, I want them with me. Or that person I'm never going to call. I'll make for sure they're never on my set. And so I've connected with a few people that have been, I think, lifelong friends, you know, OGs that come and have bled with me time and time again. People like Brent Christie, who's DP'd almost everything I've made since college, and a friend of mine, Andrew Bradford, who's a focus puller and a cinematographer on his own. He helped me make My Brother Jordan. And it's people like that that I can rely on, because I get asked a lot by kids living all over different states, aspiring and filmmakers and the like, saying, I don't know how to find crew. And I, you know, that's a valid question. But I mean, my first crew was my brother. My first leading man was my brother. You know, right. My first cast was my friends that, you know, would ride bikes to our house and play basketball. So it started small for me. And now I'm able to befriend some actors that have legitimate skills and legitimate dreams of doing this full time, lifelong, big stuff, small stuff, stuff they care about. And it's started small for me, and I've been able to connect with those people that I think are in it to win it and are like-minded. And I've never been someone who wants to kind of date around. Like, I'm not trying to have, you know, maybe to a fault, testing out a bunch of crew every film. I'm looking for a group that I can call every movie. You know, I'm not interested in trying to make a movie with different people every time. And I know when you get bigger and bigger, there's a lot of turnover. But for me, the core group of people, I feel like I sort of have, and I'm grateful to have them behind me. So it's something that doesn't come easy. I know a lot of people don't have that. A lot of people have it way more than me, but it's really important for me, because I'm going to make the movies no matter what. I'm going to find a way, but I'd love, if you want to do it with me, you're welcome anytime. So,
yeah. How did you get involved with Ryan Connolly, Film Riot, those guys? What was the point of entry there? Because you guys seem to have done quite a few things together.
Twitter. I was just a college student. Well, I was a high schooler watching Film Riot, and then I was in college, you know, not studying for tests, watching Film Riot episodes. And I had just tweeted Ryan a few times, hey, I've made this sketch, made this short film, would love some notes, you know. Was always messaging or emailing or trying to connect with people I respected, and Ryan was very high on that list. And he just occasionally would respond with, you know, a very brief 140 characters of, yeah, your pacing is good. And, you know, he wasn't ripping me to shreds, but he wasn't also, you know, filling my head up with, you know, fake compliments. And through the years, he just followed me. I didn't know that at the time. I don't think he technically followed me on Twitter, but it was when I made number 14, actually, which was just to have a stunt reel. I wanted to do a fight scene. I wanted to tell a story, but I wanted to have a fight scene for a little stunt reel. And he saw it on Twitter and then emailed me and said, we need to work together. And then he flew me to Texas and we connected over proximity. And of course, that's a really violent, you know, gruff film, to where it happened in a span. We were supposed to shoot another film that fell through. We had all this gear, Ryan, they still wanted to make a movie. And so we basically came up with something on the spot to go, we have these three people, these four things. We have this location. They went and wrote, him and us, Seth Worley went and wrote this little short. And then me, Josh Conley, and Todd Bruno got in the mud and fought and had a great time. And then proximity was what it was. And that kind of established our friendship as, again, us both willing. I mean, it was a really tough thing to make. It's not something I would recommend people trying. And it was just the perfect thing that we were able to accomplish and all kind of look at each other like, you're just as crazy as me. Let's do it again. So that sparked a friendship that has been tethered for years. So it's been a really cool thing. I mean, proximity, getting in the mud, fighting was like a love language, you know, for us. So it's like, was it good? And he's like, oh yeah, it's gnarly.
Right.
We could do it again. Let's go harder. So I think Ryan really enjoyed kind of the psychotic nature of us being willing to go to war for him, because at that time he had been making most of his films with just his family, so to speak. So he didn't have many insane guys like myself that were like, I'll be fine, but throw me down the hill, you know? And so like any director, when you see an actor, when you see a crew member that's willing to go there with you, that's like, that excites you, that trust, that friendship. So you look at him and you nod. And that was where our friendship was born.
And yeah, you've been with him through a number of movies now. I mean, were you on the crew for Ballistic as well? I think I remember seeing your name.
Yeah, so I did the Texas shoot. They shot some, I did the LA version. They shot some in Texas later that I wasn't able to be there on. But I worked full time for them from almost 2 years, 2016 to almost 2018. But this isn't public yet, but it probably will be by the time this podcast comes out. So I could tell you, but I'm actually moving back to Texas to go work full time with Film Riot again.
Okay.
That's
exciting.
Yeah. So I'm moving there in like a little over a month. So it's coming fast. We'll hopefully make some more cool stuff that, you know, maybe it won't be drowning me, but hopefully it'll be cool. So it'll be fun to connect and get Film Riot going again.
That sounds great. Yeah, because I was actually, I don't know if you've got any inside information on this, but there were a series of films that all seem to be connected to each other. So there's Proximity, Ballistic. So was there a through line with those ones as well? Sentinel was the other
one. Yeah, Sentinel. Yeah, if you look at the actual font, if you look at how it's all all caps except the I. So Sentinel came about, I don't even remember how it kind of... Ryan wanted to experiment and do a visual effects heavy little action thing. And then it kind of spawned on him that he could connect these worlds a little bit. So I think he's working on something grander in the world of Proximity, Sentinel and Ballistic. Yeah. I mean, Ballistic was the title lives up to it. So yeah, they are connected. I don't fully know where he's taking it or if he's going to take it anywhere else, but yeah, if you just look at the lowercase I, that'll tell you they're connected.
I was just wondering if Samuel L. Jackson's going to show up in a post-credit scene and tease the next one or anything like that.
Ryan would love that, I'm sure. We all would. Yeah. I'll make sure to let Ryan see if he can work on that.
Yeah, definitely. Please do. But yeah, I mean, just kind of going back to your films for a moment. There was a through line, as I mentioned before, where each film to varying degrees at least seems to be a meditation on either death or grief. Is that something that just kind of organically came about as you came up with these stories, or was it a way of you kind of processing everything that had happened with your brother and exploring different areas and aspects of grief? Was that intentional, or did that just kind of happen?
I think all the above. I mean, it's something that I'll be living for the rest of my life. For those who don't know, my best friend, brother, died of cancer in 2008. I was 11 days before my 18th birthday. He was 5 days before his 21st birthday. We were incredibly close. He was the glue to my life, to our family. He was, you know, the connective tissue to everything. And he was patient. I wasn't. He was kind. I wasn't. And we balanced each other out pretty beautifully. And I'm a pretty raw, you know, uncut type of person. And he just made my life work by the way that he was. It wouldn't have worked with someone else. And so when he died, obviously, you know, like you've probably heard before, when people die and you say, well, that I grew up really fast. I think that happened, but I wouldn't say I was mature. You grew up in a different way, but I wouldn't say it was all maturity. So my filmography kind of took on a parallel of things I was interested in. I had kind of grown up in a world where I didn't always feel people were fully honest about reality. And what I had experienced was real. And the reality, the end of the story, so to speak, was not the most beautiful thing in the world. And so I wanted to be unafraid in telling myself that reality happens. And it'll happen the way that you obviously don't expect, or an incredibly gnarly way that life just is. I mean, you can't have life without death. And not a lot of people talk about death. I mean, it's a weird subject to talk about. Sure, it's probably an awkward one for a lot of people, but I just learned very quickly that the vocabulary of death was so minimal. And I thought, man, we've been on this planet for a while, and this is the best conversation that we can have about something that's innately human. no matter what you believe, religious or not, you know, we know we're all probably going to die. There's no probably, we're all going to die at some point. And some people die really tragic early. Some people die in their sleep when they're 90. That's just life. You know, my brother was a good kid, and somewhere in Florida, some old rapist is retiring and sitting on the beach unaffected by capture. That's life. And that sucks.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in conversations about those on the screen and about the validity of the tears and that they're legitimate. But at the same time, you know, I with my relationship with Jordan, we laughed more than we ever were probably serious. And we did have our serious moments, but we laughed a lot. And so there are some scripts I'm working on and have written that reflect the lighter side. So it's not all like Papa the Pizza Man is very heavy, but it's very quirky. And, you know, hopefully there's some laughter, even if it's the awkward kind. And that's kind of my life. There's no set balance of it's just sad. It's just depressing. It's just happy. It's just light. It's everything. I mean, life to me, my life experience is all the genres. It's had its horror movies. It's had its suspense movies. Yeah. You know, your sci-fi from time to time, but relatively it's a drama. You know, I had just done Guest of Honor at the time before I made Snowbirds, and this older lady who I met, who was a recent widow, and I actually put her in Guest of Honor. She was the lady at the end. She was not an actress, but we had this personal connection, and through her life and through things I was going with was kind of what spurred Snowbirds. So it was, that film kind of was birthed through what I experienced, but kind of through her eyes, so to speak. So I'm always listening. And so whatever is around me that's talking to me, I listen. And that's usually what the film will probably be about next.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, despite, you know, the theme of loss or related topics to that, you know, it's not always doom and gloom. You know, I think there are very special and intimate parts of life that you discover through going through that process and that make it onto the screen when you tell those stories. And one of the things that I picked up on in Snowbirds and my brother Jordan as well is that you're not afraid to be funny, and not just like kind of funny, just like laugh out loud funny. Like like in Snowbirds, the very first scene, that line, "It's orange, you can't fix it," when she's trying to sort out his sweat. That one actually made me laugh out loud. You know, you don't expect to have a laugh out loud moment in a movie about someone coping with the loss of their partner. You know what I mean? And throughout my brother Jordan as well, you know, it's the sort of your hairline is your countenance thing that comes back a couple of times. Yeah. And there are some moments that do genuinely make you smile. And I think being willing to look at all of those parts, not being afraid to laugh when you are sad, when you are heartbroken, and again, not being afraid to put that on screen as part of your own personal truth, I think it's one of the bravest things I think I've probably ever seen out of any movie, short or feature. What was it that drove you to commit to doing this film, to doing My Brother Jordan, and knowing that it would be such a long road, even if you didn't know how long a road? What made you commit to doing that?
I mean, I just love my brother, and I felt like we had, you know, not mastered, but we had just melded so well. We had this amazing life together. I mean, it wasn't perfect, and there was a lot of things that were problematic in ways I grew up or things we did or regrets we have. But like, as much as it could have been, our relationship was almost perfect. And I just felt like after he died, you know, death makes conversation awkward. And so we had just moved from Florida to South Carolina. And so probably just getting into our new area, Jordan got cancer. And so anybody who knew us at that time didn't really know us as Jordan and Justin, like everyone else did prior to that experience. Because Jordan was in college, he had cancer, I was still in high school. So it was like the guy with cancer and then the guy who makes films, instead of like this 2-for-1 package deal. And I just felt like no one was talking about him. I didn't hear anybody talk about him. I didn't hear anybody share a memory. I didn't hear. And I just wanted to talk about him. I didn't want to let death do to me what I saw it do to other people. But the main reason was he deserved, you know, the spotlight. And I wanted to do more than just speak at his funeral. I wanted to do more than, you know, post something on the anniversary of his death. That's not how I roll. So I had all this footage. I had all these stories. I had this fire inside me, and nothing was going to stop me from telling it. And I was really green. I was a really in the stages of infancy as a filmmaker. You know, I had a DSLR. I knew how to edit, so to speak, but I was still really learning life, let alone learning filmmaking. So it was this really great marriage of those things, life and filmmaking and learning. And then, you know, of course, it took 8 years, which was not the goal or recommended time period by anyone. So it really hit me the one time my friend said, in telling someone else, oh yeah, Justin's been working on this for the better part of a decade, instead of saying like 7 years. And I was like, whoa, that's better part of a decade is scary. You know, a century, whew, decade.
Yeah.
And so it was just this weird journey that I had to have. And I'm just kind of like, wow, geez, man. Because I know what it took, but I'm also, I can look back and go, good for you, man. Like, what thing can go wrong when you're fueled by love? You know, the film is what it is. It's flawed. Obviously, it's not perfect. I mean, we used every type of camera, every format. There's things that work. There's things that don't. But what you can't doubt is the heart in the film.
Yeah. I mean, it is a mind-blowing accomplishment with the amount of time it must have taken to gather that much material and then to put it all together into a pretty tight narrative, actually. That process being, what would you say, 7-8 years it took to do that. What were people's reactions when you initially approached them about doing an interview about joining?
I would say probably 95% very, very positive. Most of the people that knew Jordan loved Jordan. I mean, I don't know anybody who really thought Jordan was a jerk. So most people were more than happy to make time. There were a couple of people, some close to Jordan and me at the time, some not, that were, I think, just scared to be honest on camera. I mean, it's a big ask to ask people to remember something that happened years ago. And there's a lot of, especially males, that have a hard time talking about things. And so I think there was a little bit of fear in that to be, quote, naked on the screen, to kind of show your emotions. And
right.
So there's a few people that turned me down in interviews. There's a few people that ghosted me, but relatively 95%, I would say, was more than happy to spend 20 minutes, an hour, 2 hours with me talking about Jordan. And usually they left happier than I was, just because they had remembered this beautiful thing and they realized it's exactly how I remember it. My memory hasn't betrayed me. You know, all those things are true, which was one of the reasons I wanted to make that movie, is because I had seen and felt and experienced Jordan, and I wanted to almost double check that my memory was as good as it was. So when I started pulling up all the footage, and in one instance, there was instead of it being on a tape, there was somebody recorded one of our games on a DVD at the time, a CD or something, and it wasn't working. I could not transfer it.
Okay.
And I had to actually send it off to this company, and because I had done all the transferring myself, and I sent off this company, they sent it back, and all the footage was there. They were able to pull it off. And man, I just wept, because it was like proof. It was evidence I needed. Like, I broke the case. I knew who the killer was. You know, I was just the detective on the case for my whole life. And I went, there it is. There it is. And so it was this beautiful moment to where I felt alone, but I knew what the truth was. So I was like, I don't know if anybody believes me. I don't know if anybody wants to know the story, but I want to watch it.
Yeah. This seemed like a hell of a guy. I mean, just reading some of the comments on the video, one of the recurring messages I'd noticed is that, you know, I really wish I got a chance to know him. What were some of the stories you learned through the process that surprised you or that you didn't know about Jordan?
Yeah, no, there was one that a guy shared. We grew up in Louisiana for kind of our childhood part of our lives. And again, most of Jordan's life, I was right next to him. So there weren't many things that I experienced that he didn't, and vice versa. So there was this one guy in particular who just starts sharing, and there was kind of a flavor of regret in his voice in regards to looking back at the time he spent with Jordan, saying, man, I didn't really have any priorities. And he was kind of tiptoeing around this thing. And he goes, man, I remember this one story where they were at church and they were playing tag or something, a group of boys. And in this group, there was one particular guy who was like a grade A bully. like the classic movie bully. He just bullied everybody, but it was such a small group that kind of everyone, he was always there. And so Jordan and these few guys run and they're playing hide and go seek or tag or something. And this bully finds Jordan and for no reason, unprovoked, just punches him in the stomach. And then the guy who was a bystander, who's the guy I'm interviewing, you know, 20 years later, just goes, yeah, I don't know why, but for whatever reason, I just thought, oh, that's the right thing to do is to punch Jordan in the stomach. So again, a second person, totally unprovoked, punches Jordan in the stomach. And so Jordan takes two punches, apparently, in like a bathroom at a church. And that night, this guy is like feeling really a lot of regret because he was, quote unquote, a friend to Jordan. But for whatever reason, peer pressure, he just, you know, reacted as some kids do without thinking. And Jordan called him on the phone that night. And Jordan was crying. And they're like maybe 10 years old at the time. And he's telling this friend, hey, I'm so sorry for whatever I did to provoke you to hit me. And this guy is going, wow, no, man, actually, you didn't do anything. And in when I was hearing this, my blood initially boiled the first time. He's, you know, like, I was unaware that you hit my brother because I was the much smaller, younger brother, but I would have bit your head off. Jordan would have hugged you. I would not have. So first hearing that, you're like, what? You? And Jordan was the grade A candidate to be bullied. He often wouldn't even know that you're a bully. He just thought everyone, he saw everyone's positive side. He saw the best in everybody. So he would be surprised and heartbroken to even realize that you wronged him. Like, it would take him a while to realize fully what is happening. Like, no, that kid has no good intentions. He did this because he's a dick. And that would take Jordan longer than the average Joe. So this story was really telling for two reasons, that Jordan was that naive, but also beautifully innocent, that he didn't punch back. He took it and then thought, I must have done something for my friend to punch me. Often the language of childhood boys is a physical punch, violence, you know, pushing, shoving. And, you know, on the flip, it was this beautiful moment where this guy had spent so many years after Jordan had died, after we moved away, you know, we moved away in like 1999, and it really impacted him. And it was really kind of beautiful. I didn't get a chance to put it in the documentary just because of time. It's like a 5-minute story that is kind of unglued to anything else. But I share that story in the book I'm writing about Jordan. And it's just this beautiful moment to where you're like, what 10-year-old kid does that? You know? And you might think that's a negative thing. He should have stood up for himself. He should have reacted. There were times where Jordan did stand up for himself, or when I was there, I would have definitely punched back in Jordan's stead. But it really struck me, and I did not know that story. So it was quite infuriating and beautiful.
Wow. That's powerful. It's powerful. I mean, did hearing stories like that, or even stories that you maybe already knew, did any of this help to shape your perspective, not just of Jordan, but just of, you know, just basic concepts of love or family in a way that you didn't expect?
I wouldn't say not that I didn't expect it. One thing that was really helpful was, one of the reasons I wanted to make the film was because I wanted to tell the truth. To talk about Jordan, for me, is telling the truth. And so I didn't want to make a film that, you know, like one person shared in the documentary, when he died, no one had to lie about who he was. And that's the truth. And so one of the questions that I asked every interviewee was, Jordan was what? Fill in the blank. It could be one word. It could be a story. It could be a sentence. Jordan was kind. Jordan was patient. Whatever it is. So after, you know, like 100 interviews, you hear all these people say the same thing. They say peaceful. He was, you know, loving. He was patient. Like all of these beautiful things that if I had only been interviewed and just said my brother's great, I feel like it would have been a little hollow. And so it would have just been a small little portrait. And I think with everybody given their perspective, which again was the truth, it helped paint a larger picture.
I mean, obviously it was an incredibly long road. At what point did you realize you were done? You know, at what point were you like, okay, either that I've got enough material, or you must have recut it countless times. You know, at what point were you like, okay, this is what I'm going to put out now. This is truth here.
Yeah, that is a good question. I mean, the first cut to give you an idea, which I knew it wouldn't be this long, but I just wanted to throw everything at the wall, was 1 hour and 37 minutes. The final film is 63 minutes and 50 seconds. And so when it was down to that, I knew it was August of 2018 when I locked the cut. The film didn't come out till August 2020. So I had been in a long 2-year purgatory of waiting for music and sound and color. And it took what it took, and I didn't make any edit changes, but it kind of gave me the time to solidify the decisions I had made as this locked picture cut is in front of me. And, you know, like, you know, if you make a film and you have to proof the credits and proof the color and you don't want to miss anything. I mean, imagine proofing an hour long, heart-wrenching thing 1,000 times just to make sure the fonts are right. Like, it was this very tedious thing that I was doing to where I could, like, kind of put on a different hat. I could put on, like, the brother hat. I could put on the filmmaker hat. I could put on the, like, critic hat. But I think it was August 2020 when I just called it. I mean, there were people that said, oh, it should be shorter. It should be 70 minutes so that film festivals can program it better. It should be 10 minutes shorter. It should be 60 minutes exactly. And I tried to make it as short as I could. Mm-hmm. Like, I usually do everything. It's got to be as short as it can. But there was a point where I said, if I start cutting this out, the truth becomes tampered with. And I this project, more than anything, I wanted to tell the truth and said, so if I tamper with this, it would be tampering with the integrity of the story. So if it's 3 minutes extra and that's what the failure is in the film, I'll take that in the mouth because it's the truth. So I'm not going to cut this character out. I'm not going to add this. It is what it is, period. There's no question mark. And so I would say August 2018 is when I called it. You know, I know there was a friend I did a podcast with recently. He said that at film school, they say films are never finished. They're just abandoned. And in some ways, you know, that's true because you could somehow keep telling the story, but I felt like I had said what I wanted to say, so to speak, in that format. So, of course, I'm here now trying to write a book and I still have things to say. So in a different vehicle that I think are, because of the documentary, I felt like there were so many stories that I couldn't tell for time, pace, or, you know, any reason. And, I've always wanted to write books as well as write movies. And this kind of gave me the opportunity to kind of finish unloading what's inside.
Because I'll tell you what, one of the things that really struck me when I watched it the first time, and definitely when I've on repeat viewings, is how tight a narrative it is and how it seems to utilize all of the skills you seem to have built over the course of making all the other films in your filmography and how they all seem to have been applied to this film, particularly in the editing and in streamlining the narrative. But what really struck me is that you had the presence of mind to know what needed to go in the film and what you could afford to lose. I mean, aside from the fact that you're having to deal with this unimaginable loss, you know, every single memory is going to be a precious one. You know, there aren't going to be those kind of side memories that you just kind of forget about. It's like, oh, that wasn't important. Every single one of them is going to be important to you. So I guess my question is, how did you maintain the discipline and the presence of mind to know what the story was and to know what you had to absolutely have in there and what you could afford to leave out?
It's another good question. I mean, instinct goes a lot. I mean, experience of literally what I experienced, the high moments and the low moments. And, you know, if you asked any filmmaker, you held a gun to their head and said, make a story about a dead loved one and make sure you put the exact right thing. Don't put in a second longer, you know, that's not needed. That's a tough thing. So I didn't over pressure myself, but I knew what the story was. I mean, the story I had lived and the story I had watched. So I was able to see myself and Jordan and the narrative as characters. So that probably made it a lot easier than instead of seeing them as myself and as my brother, I was able to see a little bit of thematically, narratively, that this is a story so that I don't get too emotionally attached to something. Cause I can kind of do two things at once. I can be emotionally attached and I can be detached as an editor. I didn't want to make a film where I invited an audience to my house and I showed them 8 hours of home videos. that I thought were funny, when in reality it's inside right. jokes and no one's going to enjoy. Yeah. So I didn't want to make that movie. I wanted to make something that was, you know, special. I wanted to take you to the Grand Canyon. You know, I wanted you to stand there and go, wow, that's beautiful. I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to elongate that experience. Yeah. You know, when I show it to you, you'll remember. When you see the sunset, you'll remember. And that's so great. I think through editing, the beautiful art of editing, I think I was able to try at least land that plane somewhere in that world, to where I'm not trying to overstay my welcome. And I'm not trying to say Jordan's the only loved one that's ever died. I'm the only one who's ever experienced loss. But this is my clash with it.
No, I think you definitely landed that plane 100%. I can't think of many other short films that I've rewatched as many times.
Appreciate that, man.
No. Thank you for doing it. And I appreciate you having the bravery and the wherewithal to complete that process. But you're moving in the direction of the book now. So is this going to expand upon what is already in the film, or just the stories that you didn't get to include?
Yeah, all the above. So I had started writing, you know, I had this fear of forgetting. I had this fear that I would forget something, you know, these memories that I didn't have on video were going to somehow get lost. You know, it's like if you go visited your childhood home, someone else is living there. Or it's been demolished and there's an apartment building there. There's a park there. Your memories are replaced by new ones. These places that you love are no longer there. And I didn't want to lose my childhood home and my mind. I wanted to be able to pull that scrapbook out and look at it and go, this is the truth. So there was part of that fear, you know, just as you get older and you forget things, or, you know, you're sharing a story with your friend and you're like, man, I forgot about that. And it's only 6 months ago. You know, Jordan will have been gone, you know, it'll be 13 years in August. That's a long time. And so I had started writing a book and then shelved it to start working on this documentary. And then, of course, trying to put those stories in the documentary, and not everything stuck. And then I made the documentary and I knew there was a lot of stories that I couldn't tell. And anytime I ever did tell them, it was always a pretty fun experience, because a lot of the stories are just funny. It's just childhood, you know, escapades and things that we did that do expand upon, that are in the documentary. It's a good companion piece, I would say, or the director's cut. I mean, some of the stories that I share in the documentary are in there. They might just be a little seasoned differently, but really there's just a lot left untold. And so I just had all these stories. And of course, when the documentary came out and people really enjoyed it, and people that knew me, knew Jordan, knew us together, really enjoyed remembering. And it reignited that book that had been on the shelf to go, you know what, I made this documentary firstly for myself, with hopes that, man, somebody across the ocean would enjoy it. Someone 2 miles from me would enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But firstly, I made it for me. And so I started writing the book with that same guise. And it's been a really freeing, really fun to visit and excavate my mind and go, this is the history book. You know, it's a different vehicle, a book to a documentary. And because I had so much footage growing up, that's why the documentary worked, I think. So books are totally different. I mean, there'll be a couple pictures, but just being able to paint the stories with no pictures is a different vein, a different muscle. So I've enjoyed that aspect, but it's really simply there was still stuff left to be told. And I think for me, I know people would say, why do we need a book? You know, what else is there to say? You know, Jordan is my story, you know, so it's not just his story. It's my story too. And I love telling the story of Jordan. And there's so many things that I'd love to be able to tell that my kid, who's 3 months old, one day can read about his Uncle Jordan. And what better person to tell him about him than me?
That's quite something. And look forward to that making an appearance once you're ready to release it.
Thank you, man.
But aside from the book, what else have you got planned? You mentioned you'd been writing features as well. What's next for you?
It's also a good question. So obviously I'm going to be moving to Film Riot, Texas in about a month. So summer of 2021. Working on this book that I'm hoping to have out by this fall. I'm probably going to try to self-publish. I have no experience in that world, but I'd love to write, like I said, screenplays and books one day. So this is a good start. And then, of course, I'm just trying to stack up features. So I'll be working in Texas and then just trying to focus on my writing, because I've been writing shorts for so long, and I took a long hiatus from writing altogether when I was making the documentary, that I've had these stories that have built up, and there's kind of a good line now in my mind, and I'm trying to get them out so that I can free myself for the next line, that again, one day when the timing is plausible for me to make my first feature film, that I have plenty of opportunities and not just living my life, putting all my eggs in one basket, going, I have this one script, this one feature film, and if this financier, this person, whoever, this actor doesn't like it, I don't want to be able to go, that's all I have. I know so many filmmakers that go pitch their script and they only have that one script. So if the people listening to the pitch say, we love it, we want to make that, the second question will most likely be, what else do you have? And I do not want to be the person that goes, I want to go, here's this and this and this, you know, because these are stories that are dying to get out and I'm just trying to get them out. It's not just something that I'm trying to be the, have the most scripts ever. These are stories I want to tell and I feel responsible to tell. So I'm as quickly as I can trying to get them out of my system. And things like the book, things like the documentary, things like Snowbirds, you know, they are what they're going to be. And that's good enough for me.
Okay. Now, well, we'll definitely look forward to you finding that spot, and definitely looking forward to what you come out with next. You've done some incredible films. You've told some amazing stories, and we're just grateful that you've allowed us to be part of your journey. So thank you so much. And thank you for sitting down with us today. Really, really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Really appreciate you, man. Thank you for your kindness and your inquisitive, and even for all these questions. It's really beautiful, man. I really appreciate it.
That was writer, director, and now author, Justin Robinson. A genuine thanks to him for taking the time out to talk to us. If you haven't watched My Brother Jordan yet, we cannot recommend it highly enough. We've included a link in the description, and you can also watch it for free on our cinema page. We have also gathered a selection of Justin's short films, which you can watch in the Justin Robinson collection, also available on our cinema page, cameolaunch.com/cinema. If you've been affected by cancer or the topics that we've discussed in this interview, we have included links to Macmillan Cancer Support and Cancer Research UK in the description. For those of you joining us from the United States, we've included links to Cancer Community Support and the American Cancer Society. They are great resources for those who need them, as well as crucial in the fight against cancer, so please use them if you feel you need them. These organizations also accept donations, so please feel free to donate what you can if you can. Thanks, as always, to all of you for joining us. If you haven't yet subscribed, we'd love it if you could. If you're joining us from podcast land, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music, Spotify, and many more. Just head to cameolaunch.com/podcast and subscribe on the platform of your choice. If you're joining us on YouTube, then please hit the subscribe button and don't forget to hit the bell for notifications. If you head to cameolaunch.com, you can create a profile to get notifications of new postings, as well as being able to rent or subscribe to the featured short films on our cinema page, including Time Travel Adventure Recursion, historical epic The German King, and the hilarious comedy Lemaire. You can also sign up to our newsletter or follow us on the socials at Cameo Launch on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We'll be back soon with a new episode in which I'll be chatting to Paul Holbrook and Sam Dorr of Shunk Films, where we'll be talking recent festival hits Hungry Joe and Shiny, as well as upcoming films Hollow and Old Windows. So make sure you tune in for that one. In the meantime, please stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time.